Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 14th day of October 2011, and today I'm honored to be joined on the line by Joseph Trento, an investigative journalist with over 35 years of experience in both broadcast and print mediums. He currently reports for the National Security News Service, which he's been doing since 1991, but before that he worked for the CNN's Special Assignment Unit and the Wilmington News Journal, and he has received 6 Pulitzer nominations and is the author of 5 books, including a book that he co-authored with David Armstrong, America and the Islamic Bomb, The Deadly Compromise. So, Joseph Trento, it's a great pleasure and an honor to have you on the program today. Thank you for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure to be on.
Excellent. Well, today I wanted to talk broadly about the subject of CIA and the nuclear black market, which is quite a large subject to get into, and one that obviously you did cover in your book, which I mentioned that you co-authored with David Armstrong. And there's a lot of different ways to, I suppose, grapple an issue like this. But one that I thought would be particularly fruitful to start with was an article that you authored on dcbureau.org back on the 24th of August, 2010, called Atif Amin Sacked for Trying to Shutter the AQCON Nuclear Proliferation Network. So for people who may not be familiar with this case or the specifics of who Atif Amin was, perhaps you can introduce listeners to this story and what it tells us about the nuclear proliferation networks.
It's one of the great outrages of the way our intelligence services work and the influence they have over their governments. Atif Amin was a very high-level customs officer in the British Royal Customs Service, a very smart guy of Pakistani extraction. And it was unusual for somebody of his background to rise to the level he did. Amin became known to us as we worked on the research for the book, and he wouldn't talk to us. We learned that he discovered the AQCON network's operations in Dubai in April of 2000. And it became very clear in our investigation that MI6, the British External Intelligence Service, and the CIA, and MI5 all had reasons for not letting him continue with the investigation. When he attempted to continue in the investigation and shut down some of these operations, working with the local Dubai police, they stopped him. And what's amazing is, in 2003, when the network was made public, and George Bush made a big deal about how this was going to become a very big operation, we learned that it could have been stopped 3 years earlier. And that was the great outrage, that Amin was stopped. His career at customs was stalled, and then it got worse. We met him after the book was published, which was in 2006. And he came to Washington, met us, was visiting his sister. And right after that, his house was raided. His job was taken away from him. At that time, he was on loan to a judge, and he was in charge of doing all the British wiretaps. That was his role in Britain. So he had a fairly high-level position. They went after him. I tried to contact the British authorities and basically say, you know, you're wrong. He was not our source, and that's what he was being accused of. And it was one of the great injustices. Amin is still unemployed, still out of work, occasionally does some security consulting. But the fact of the matter is the AQCON network could have been stopped 3 years sooner, and it was not. And part of the reason it was not was because the CIA wanted to protect its relationship with Khan, and British intelligence wanted to protect its relation with Peter Griffin, who was one of Khan's cohorts, and Ernst Tinner, who was another cohort, and there are others. But the bottom line is, if you follow the Khan case through, everybody got a slap on the wrist. The only thing something really bad happened to was Atif Amin, the guy who exposed the network. It's outrageous. What's even more outrageous is elements of the Khan operation, businesses, front groups, are still operating in Dubai. And I will tell you that one of the great sadnesses of my professional career is that the non-proliferation community, the community that's supposed to be interested in preventing proliferation, did not come to the rescue of this man. They did nothing. And further, the media, which is supposed to be interested in these kinds of stories, did nothing either. 60 Minutes, the great institutions that I've worked with in the past, basically walked away from this story. In fact, at the very time I proposed a story on what was going on in Dubai, 60 Minutes instead did a story on how wonderful Dubai was and becoming this great international thing and how terrific the prince who runs it is. and when in fact he was aided terrorism and done other things.
Well, it is absolutely outrageous. In fact, it's kind of beyond outrageous. It's a complete affront to anyone who really believes that the intelligence agencies are there to prevent the proliferation of nuclear weapons. It seems to fly directly in the face of that assumption. So I guess for people who aren't familiar with the specifics of the AQCON network and how it developed, perhaps you can give us a bit of a chronology of that and some of the key events in the development of that network.
Well, the two things to remember about the CON network is nothing can develop like this without an intelligence service picking it up. The fact of the matter is England and the United States both looked the other way. We knew that there an Islamic bomb was being built. It was largely financed by the Saudis and inadvertently by the United States at first, and later we picked up on it. What was happening was money that we were giving Pakistan for the Mujahideen and other intelligence operations they were helping us with was being diverted into this program. And administration after administration ignored it. And one of the great tragedies, of course, is this all started back with the Adams for Peace program. And the U.S. has been absolutely two-faced on proliferation for the entire length that nuclear weapons have gotten into the hands of other countries. We fundamentally are demanding that Iran not have a weapon when Israel has had a weapon for decades, since the early 1960s, and we ignore that. That dichotomy is something we ignore. Now, Israel is a democracy, a real democracy. It's a different kind of environment. But from the perspective of somebody in India or in Iran or other countries, this idea that the United States would allow certain people to have weapons and other people not to have, in other words, remain undeclared, is absurd. So Pakistan, fearful of India, of course, but Pakistan decided they were going to pursue a program and did. And they got help from North Korea. They got help from – they in turn helped North Korea with missiles. They got – and then the minute they had enough technology that had some value, which largely came out of AQCON's experience at Urenco, which was a company that has a notorious history of leaking information, the operation started. And the CON network was created not by AQCON. The CON network was created by the Pakistani government in order to get foreign currency back in exchange for the money they put into this research. That's what the CON network was about. It still is. CON never flew anywhere when he wasn't on an army plane guarded by Pakistani army officials. The whole idea that this was some rogue operation run by this scientist, this metallurgist, is nonsense.
Well, you make an important point that this type of network can't possibly develop without intelligence agencies picking up on it, and I think it's important to flesh out why that's the case. So for those of us who aren't really familiar with the mechanics of building a nuclear weapon, perhaps you can talk about some of the incredibly sophisticated technology and things that go into this that the intelligence agencies would be picking up along the way.
Well, I mean, first of all, let's just I want to disabuse your viewers and listeners and readers of one thing. The intelligence community wanted Pakistan to have a weapon because Pakistan was considered a frenemy, kind of a friendly enemy, although these days they're more an enemy than a friend. But the reality is we thought we could control them. That was the mythology. And every time one of the CIA experts on the region brought up the idea that there's an Islamic, extreme Islamic element that the Pakistani intelligence services support, and you need to deal with that, you need to accept that, they were ignored. And this is very important because this went on for years and years and years. Basically, the way we looked at it was, look, we've got to let them have a weapon. They want a weapon. Let them have a weapon as a hedge against India. We have Israel secretly helping India develop its program. And at that time, we also had Israel secretly helping South Africa in the battle South Africa, the apartheid state. So we were playing these kind of manipulative games. And so the idea that we knew what they were doing. And in fact, during the Clinton administration, when they finally tested and became a declared nuclear state, the Clinton administration basically ignored it. I mean, so this idea that CON's operations were secret are nonsense. Now, what did we get out of it? here's what was going through the mind of the agency. Better to have somebody in the network you're working with who could give you information about the network than shut down the network. That's what they thought. And an argument can be made for that. The problem is they missed the proliferation. They were so stupid in the way they handled it. They had the wrong sources. Khan was quite clever in the companies that they were dealing with. And Dubai for the United States is a nightmare, because even though we have a large CIA presence in Dubai, the Dubai operations were the perfect place for them to do these illegal weapons transfers and technology transfers. And we lost track of it. And that's fundamentally what happened. And when you have all the elements from, you know, centrifuges to designs, the reason the Operation Aiken, which was the customs operation British intelligence ran, that our friend Atif Amin ran, was so important was that he did a raid on Peter Griffin's house in France and got off of Peter Griffin's computers the designs for the actual centrifuges and other equipment that were needed. And this was the first proof that this stuff was being sold to Libya, later to Iran and other places. But the reality was this information was so vital and so important. But the minute that raid took place, that information was shared with the United States. So there was no excuse for us not knowing. Then the mood began at CIA and at MI6 headquarters. Okay, we've got to protect our resources. So they circle the wagons. And when they circle the wagons, what they're telling you is our sources and methods are more important to protecting than the public from proliferation. And that's what happened.
Well, that does seem to be the case. So as it turns out, the Tinner family supposedly was the tip-off of this specific shipment to Libya that really unwound the case. Perhaps you can talk a little bit about the Tinner family and their involvement in this.
Well, I'm not an expert on the Tinner family. We and others have written about them. But Ernst Tinner and his family were longtime operatives. The CIA had thick files on them. They knew what they were doing. And what's so remarkable about it is when Swiss authorities moved on, the agency made no effort to aid them. The State Department was basically told, do everything you can to protect these people. Don't encourage them to be put on trial. Don't do anything. And what essentially happened was this protection worked. And what was really outrageous is the physical evidence, the documents showing them involved in the shipments of equipment, showing them involved as middlemen in all of this, were destroyed. I mean, the Tinner family is, they were just cogs in what was an intelligence operation. And ISI, the Inter Services Intelligence of Pakistan, was so important to us to protect that we ignored the fact, we either didn't know or ignored the fact that two things were happening. One is Bin Laden's people were meeting with scientists connected to the program to see about getting a weapon, see if it was possible for them to do that. And two, the Saudi intelligence service, the general intelligence director to Saudi Arabia, which is was supposed to be an ally of the United States, was actually aiding the program. So you had these two things going on. And what it reflected was a lack of counterintelligence, both by the British and the United States, where we really weren't examining the people we were recruiting or thought we were recruiting.
I must admit, it does strain the bonds of credulity to ask the public to believe that even though every single layer of this network was infested with long-term operatives who were reporting directly to the intelligence agencies, that they just somehow just couldn't put the pieces together about the proliferation side of this. And it does raise the question, at the very least, if this can all be chalked up to genuine incompetence, then what faith can the public put in these intelligence agencies for this not to happen again and again until something fundamentally changes?
Well, I mean, look, at this point, there's nobody in the world who covers these issues, looks at these issues, who has any illusions about all this. It's a little like, there's another example of what you're talking about going on right now. And had it not been for Fukushima, no questions would have been raised about it. The entire U.S. and European non-nuclear proliferation policy is based on the idea that you can take nuclear weapons and turn them into MOX fuel. Okay? That's the idea. The United States is now spending $10 billion on one of these plants at the Savannah River site in South Carolina. They don't even know if it'll work. There are no customers for this fuel. And post-Fukushima, nobody wants anything because MOX was in reactor number 3 at Fukushima. The point is, the money's still being spent. It's still going forward. Why? Because the policy was created before they knew that the National Nuclear Security Administration couldn't deliver on the promise. Okay? That's a metaphor, a bit of a metaphor for what happened with AQCon. They thought, we can control it. We can watch his operations. It will tell us who the bad guys are dealing with. It'll give us insight into what North Korea is up to, and we can control it. And they lost control. Now, you know, I mentioned the NNSA business with MOX. Another example of that is with the Saudis is we thought GID had Al-Qaeda penetrated. Unfortunately, the two agents we were relying on who worked for Saudi intelligence ended up crashing a plane into the Pentagon. So these mistakes are made. Now, out of defense of the intelligence community, bad decisions are taken every day in industry, in government, in every sector of in media, in every sector of our lives. But these decisions seem to be so bad, so incredibly idiotic, but worse have such far-reaching consequences that the public deserves better. And they didn't get better. And the thing about the Atifa Min story, the reason it's so illustrative of this, is people who try and stop it are punished, and punished in unbelievable ways. Sibel Edmonds had the same experience in the FBI. And it's the punishment, it's the way these bureaucracies protect themselves, it's this covering your ass attitude. And in the case of nuclear weapons, nothing could be more serious.
That's exactly right. This is one of the most important strategic challenges of the 21st century, to secure nuclear stockpiles and to really prevent proliferation, as I think everyone involved in this field knows. So really it raises the question, what possibility is there to hold these agencies accountable for their immense ineptitude?
Sadly, Japan may be responsible for through this horrible tragedy at Fukushima, for putting the brakes on a lot of this. Once again, the people are really raising questions about this ridiculous tie-in between nuclear civilian power and weapons. The reality of the Japanese situation is fascinating because I've done a lot of research in this area, and Japan was not going to do reprocessing. They weren't going to do any of this until the United States basically turned over all of our failed programs to them, had them adopt them. And Japan basically turned it had a secret nuclear weapons program for the entire time that Israel did, kept it secret from the Japanese public, and basically ran it through their power companies. And it's one of the great tragedies. We're going to be launching before the end of the year a 5 or 6 part series on Japan's nuclear program and what really led up to all this. But the reality is that the tragedy now has people raising questions. Unfortunately, the Obama administration has been extremely diffident to the National Nuclear Security Administration, which is part of the U.S. Department of Energy, which basically controls nuclear weapons and controls all proliferation issues, technically. That power they have is enormous. And what nobody wants to talk about is the fact that there is, in fact, a nuclear kind of priesthood where these guys don't want to give up any plutonium. They don't want to give up any uranium. They'll do anything and come up with any excuse to keep this stuff because they think it's so valuable. They think it is a resource that can be converted energy, and just in case if we ever need a weapon, we can quickly turn it into a weapon. That attitude is what you're up against. And combining with that attitude are giant contractors who make huge amounts of money. I mean, look, Areva, which makes MOX fuel, the French company, which is government owned, if that company were to go out of business, it would have an incredibly detrimental effect to the French government. That's why Atomic Annie, who then headed the company, rushed to Japan the minute the accident happened. We were the ones who broke the story about the fact that they were using MOX in the number 3 reactor and had been loaded in the previous September before the reactor melted down. This lack of information that the public has about these things that are being done is at the heart of the problem. Had the Japanese public been dealt with in a more straightforward manner by its government, by the utility companies, I have enough confidence in the intelligence of the Japanese people to think that they would have not reacted well. In the United States, people don't pay as much attention, unfortunately. But this accident is galvanized the world.
It certainly has, and obviously, situated in Japan as I am, it's heartening in a way, I suppose, to see the public reaction and the growing anger at the government and the way that they've been treated by the government and TEPCO, and obviously the collusion that's happening there. But on that note of the Japanese people and how the entire nuclear industry developed here, obviously, I mean, Japan has had historical opposition to nuclear weapons and nuclear energy for
right.
obvious reasons. But I found it interesting to note that one of the first major editorials in a daily newspaper here that originally propounded the idea of putting nuclear energy in Japan was in essentially written by the CIA and handed over to the editorial board of, I believe, the Daily Yomiuri. Do you
right.
have any more information about the development of the nuclear industry here?
The nuclear industry in Japan was a creation of U.S. intelligence. The decision was that we would turn over the technology and other materials. Remember, Japan had a nuclear program during the war. In fact, a submarine, a U-boat was sent from Germany. As Germany was falling, a U-boat was sent from Germany to Japan carrying what technology and information they had. An old co-author of mine, Bill Corson, who's a Marine officer, one of his jobs, he spoke fluent Japanese, and one of his jobs just at the end of the war was to find the Japanese scientists who were working on the Japanese bomb program. Now, that program never developed in anything of any significance. It never had a time to. But there was a program. So the seeds for this were set. What the CIA did that was so dangerous but so brilliant was there's always been a strong element of Japanese nationalism, small but strong. They played off of that. And by the 1960s, they were able to get the Japanese government to invest secretly in the program by providing vast amounts of aid. And we did that. The most hilarious affront to the U.S. taxpayer was we built Breeder Reactor, and the technology was a disaster. We almost had a nuclear tragedy in Alabama at Browns Ferry that was unparalleled. That technology was secretly turned over to Japan in mass. And that became the basis for the modern Japanese program. Now, what's happened is very interesting. Japan acquired vast amounts of plutonium, as much as the United States and Russia had with all their warheads. England did the same thing. I believe they ended up with 90 tons before the announcement of the closing of Sellafield, their reprocessing facility. There is nothing more dangerous than plutonium. You can't store it safely, especially in an earthquake-prone country. And the irony here is, in Japan, you've got, I forget the amount, but it's tons and tons of the stuff. In the United States, we have about 60 tons being stored at the Savannah River site. A certain irony, because it's being stored in an old reactor that almost melted down during the Reagan administration on the worst earthquake fault in the South. It has to be, to make MOX fuel, it has to be put into oxide form, ground into a powder. That's when plutonium is its most dangerous, because if it gets in the atmosphere, it's going to kill lots of people. A plume from that location at Savannah River, which is about 600 miles from Washington, D.C., would ironically blow north to Washington. That's where the plume would go because of our winds here, and could kill everybody between the two places. So what we're talking about is playing with the most dangerous substance man has ever created, and doing it in a way that basically is a fraud. the idea that you can convert this stuff to a safe fuel that, and in the process not produce more waste. Here's the deal. The only thing you can do with radioactive byproducts is isolate them and store them. Every process produces more. The MOX process produces much hotter stuff. So what you end up getting with MOX is a residue that's much worse than you began with. And this is what Japan has been doing. And this is what the United States wants to do. Jimmy Carter closed the first U.S. reprocessing facility before it ever opened. He wouldn't give it a chance to open. It's right outside the gates at Savannah River. They now use it to practice attacks on nuclear facilities. But it was closed, and he was greatly criticized for it because he worried about proliferation issues. The late Paul Laventhal of the Nuclear Control Institute used to rail about these Japanese boats that would go pick up the waste plutonium and bring them to Japan for reprocessing because they had no protection. And if a terrorist was a mind to, attacking one of those boats and taking the stockpile plutonium would be a fairly simple matter. And we're in that situation still today.
Absolutely. A very worrying situation, and very worrying indeed that just recently it's been confirmed that plutonium was found up to 45 kilometers, I believe, from the Fukushima plant. So it is quite an incredibly worrying situation that's obviously still developing. So very much looking forward to your 5-6-part series on the Japanese nuclear power.
Right. What the series is a history of how it actually happened physically, how the transfers were made to Japan of the technology, who was responsible in the U.S. government. And I think once the public reads this series, they will have a sense of exactly how it happened and why the United States was so insensitive over the years about allowing weapons to be brought into Japanese-controlled territory. I mean, this charade that was played between Japan and the United States is a disgrace.
To put it mildly, absolutely. All right, well, on that note, let's talk a little bit about the Public Education Center and the D.C. Bureau, of which you're an editor.
Well, it's been around since 1989. We have two news services, the National Security News Service, and then we have Natural Resources News Service. And both news services combine on the nuclear stuff because obviously there's commonality there. But what we've done, our history has been that we do the upstream work on important, difficult stories, then turn them over to the major media. We did a series with NHK in Japan on the 20th century, on weapons dealing, this sort of thing. We've done numerous stories with 60 Minutes. The New York Times story on Pentagon generals that won the Pulitzer Prize a couple of years ago originated with us. So what we try and do is find important stories that the media would not normally look into, and develop them far enough with our funds so the media would then take on and make the big investment. That model worked great for years, but it stopped working because the media is not putting much of an investment in the United States in this kind of reporting. So I had started a website for the news service called Stories That Matter, which dealt with stories that I couldn't get the media to pick up. And I'll give you some examples of big stories that the media wouldn't pick up. We had the story on the Fujimoro-FARC arms deal that brought down that government, and I'd gone to the Washington Post and New York Times with that story, and they wouldn't touch it. So what I did was I brought the reporter, Angel, who was a reporter from La Republica in Peru. I brought him to the United States. I took him to see Sarkis Soganayan at a prison in Los Angeles. The arms dealer supplied this arms deal. And he so they told him the story, ran his story, and then the Peruvian government fell. There was always a way to get a story done when others wouldn't pick it up. And I think that the web will open up independent journalism in such a way that within 5 or 6 years, there'll be an economic model that will work to fund this kind of reporting, where advertisers will come to these sites and start supporting them. And it's going to take a while. But the idea that if you're a big publication, you can keep out a story is now ending. You can't do that anymore. The New York Times used to be able to block major stories. They can't do that anymore. And that's the great thing about the sites like Sybil's and ours, that the freedom to actually do stories that couldn't get done before now can be done.
That is a note of hope, and certainly you do point to the power that the media still has occasionally when they do put their immense resources into a story. But it does raise the question of, as we move into the more of an online, internet-based medium, does that offer the opportunity for developing new methods of distributing these works, even reporting on stories like this? Does it talk to the idea that we might have more distributed forms of reporting, in which it won't be one person going on a full-time basis? It will be many people around the world working cooperatively on stories.
I think that's going to happen more. I think one of the problems we've yet to deal with, and we need to face this, is people who believe in this form of distribution of information and social media, which I think could play a major role, is that the skills of a professional reporter, professional editor, which are long honed, and that judgment needs to be applied to the methodology. If we don't have that, then you don't know how the stuff's being vetted. And that is something of great concern to me, because you need to know that the material you're getting is real. How do you know that? Well, you can only tell in old media by the experience and the track record of the organization. I think that's one part of it. The bigger part of it is educating the consumer. You got to educate young people who grew up with this technology and the generations to follow them to be skeptical of everything they see, to bring some level of intelligence to what they're looking at, and raise questions about it and teach them how to consume media. I think if those things happen, then I think this could really be worked. But to me, the ability to carry a camera this big and get 1080p video and being able to get people on the record when they're not on the record, that's just it's a reporter's dream. It's great.
It is. It's absolutely, I think, revolutionary. And it, as you say, it's a question of how we come up with the processes for dealing with these technologies and really putting them to good use. So a fascinating topic and a lot of incredible work taking place, obviously, at the Public Education Center. Can you fire out the website again for people?
Yes, it's dcbureau.org. And if you want to learn about the Public Education Center, which is the parent foundation, it's www.publicedcenter.org.
All right, excellent. Well, Joseph Trento, I thank you very much for your time today. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure.